Welcome to the Sermon Podcast of Redemption Church. The following sermon is by Pastor Gary Alloway.
So tonight we are looking at Isaiah 40, one of my favorite passages in the entire Bible, which I'm very excited about. We are starting our sermon series on the book of Isaiah. We did Elijah and Elisha this summer. We had our kickoff last week, and we're now going to spend about the next 5 months, 4 to 5 months, looking at the book of Isaiah. There's an old joke about the woman who went to see Shakespeare for the first time and was surprised by how often he quoted things. You get it? The idea, yeah, that we quote Shakespeare so often, he's so shaped our language that, yeah, she recognized half of Shakespeare. Isaiah is kind of the same way. Like we said, he's quoted 85 times in the New Testament. You might have recognized our passage for tonight from Handel's Messiah, if you've ever heard that. There's all kinds of famous things in it. The leopard lying down with the lamb, the swords beaten to plowshares. If you read through the book of Isaiah, you'd find phrases like holy, 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 and the new heavens and the new earth, both things that make it into the book of Revelation. The point being, you probably recognize a lot of Isaiah, and as we go through it, we're actually going to read some of the more famous passages, and you'll probably go, oh, that passage. Oh, I recognize. Oh, okay, that one, we say that one at Christmas every year. There's a lot in here that is really familiar. So I kind of hope that as we go through it, you actually get a larger picture of the book. You start to see how much this undergirds the New Testament. And if you're like me, you come to fall in love with the book of Isaiah because it is very good. So a little background before we dive into this book. Who was Isaiah? If you turn to page 1 of the book of Isaiah, it says this. The vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Since we all know that King Uzziah was king in around 750 BC, as we all know, the fast facts of the Old Testament that everybody knows. That's probably what they're learning in Sunday school downstairs right now. What this tells us is that Isaiah was a prophet in Judah, specifically the southern kingdom of Judah, from approximately 750 to 700 BC. There he is. And some of the context of what was going on in that time. If you're here for the Elijah-Elisha series, this was kind of the layout of the land when Elijah and Elisha were around. You had the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, and the kingdom of Judah, the split kingdom there. And then all these other kingdoms around it, Edom, Moab, Ammon, Arab. And there's kind of this jockeying between all these states during that time. This begins to radically change in the 700s BC because of the rise of Assyria. Assyria is this great military empire. There they are. They end up taking over basically the whole Mesopotamia and Canaan and into Egypt there. And they come in 722 BC, they destroy Samaria, they destroy the northern kingdom. This is where the 10 northern tribes of Israel go off into exile and never really return. And then in 701 BC, they come into Judah and they surround Jerusalem, and we have this very dramatic scene. And this actually is the scene that precedes right before our passage for today. Isaiah 36 to 39 will tell you this story. So like I said, Assyria surrounds Jerusalem, and basically this is the largest military in the ancient world, the most powerful force on earth at the time, surrounding this small city and the tiny kingdom of Judah at this point. And at that point, the Assyrians kind of get cocky. They have the city surrounded, and they begin to mock Hezekiah and Jerusalem and the God of Israel for basically their unwillingness to surrender. This is what they say to the city of Jerusalem. Do not let Hezekiah mislead you when he says, "The Lord will deliver us." Have the gods of any nation ever delivered their land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Who of all the gods of these countries has been able to save their lands from me? How then can the Lord deliver Jerusalem from my hand? So they're getting pretty cocky, right? And Hezekiah is understandably disturbed by this, and he goes and he seeks out Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah, son of Amos, our prophet. And Isaiah basically says to him, don't sweat it. The king of Assyria will not enter the city or shoot an arrow here. And that night, the angel of the Lord goes out and puts to death all 185,000 of the Assyrian soldiers. It says, when the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. And as for the king of Assyria, the one who said that no God could stand against him, he breaks camp and returns to Nineveh and there is assassinated shortly thereafter. So this story stands as this profound story of faith, faith of Hezekiah that God will deliver him, and faith of the Assyrians and their military might and the way they're defeated. But what we see from the history is that the faith of Hezekiah doesn't last. He doesn't actually learn the lesson from this incident. And instead, in the next chapter over, we see that he forges a new alliance with this rising power who can stand up to the Assyrians. And that's these guys, the Babylonians. And he welcomes the Babylonians in, and it says that he shows them all the treasures in his storehouse. And he's feeling pretty good about himself until Isaiah, our friend Isaiah, shows up again and goes, what did you show him? And he says, I showed him everything. And he goes, well, just know that these guys will be back and not as your friends. A time will come when they will come and take all of this away. And history tells us that that day comes in 586 BC. After centuries of the prophets warning Judah to turn back to God, turn back to God, turn back to God, they don't listen. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians, comes and surrounds the city of Jerusalem and breaks it and defeats it and burns it to the ground. They tear the temple to the ground. They tear the walls to the ground. They carry the entire population off into exile in Babylon. You can see the picture there, the people being led out of the city into exile. For the next 70 years, the people of Judah will be in Babylon. And I want you to remember that, because that's very important to our passage for tonight. But I'm going to take us on a little detour, because it's important to help us understand our passage. So, like Susan said, there's kind of like three different parts of the book of Isaiah. And this is the book gets a little funky here. So chapters 1 through 36 of the book of Isaiah, or 1 through 39 really, are set in this earlier period, 700 BC, when the Assyrians are coming in. It's all these prophecies about Israel, get it right, get it right, get it right, or else you're going to go into exile. And then, after we turn the page from chapter 39 to chapter 40, the tone really changes. And all of a sudden, we see all these prophecies speaking to a people that are actually in exile already. And so what a lot of people think happened is that while Israel was in exile, someone picked up the book of Isaiah and essentially wrote chapter 2, also known, like I said, by this fancy word, Deutero-Isaiah, which is just a fancy Greek way of saying second Isaiah. So that was written somewhere around 550 BC during the exile. And then when we get to chapter 56, we see a change in tone again, where the author is essentially speaking to a community that has returned from exile. And so, again, what we think happened is somebody picked up the book and wrote chapter 3. And that becomes known as Trito-Isaiah, or 3rd Isaiah, which was probably written somewhere around 500 BC. For what it's worth, this practice was actually common in the ancient world. This was what you would do if you were like a student of Plato. You would try and write as close to Plato's style as possible, and you would sign it as Plato. And nobody really thought that was like weird. That was like the thing. It's like, it's Plato, kind of in quotes. That's in the same way, you know, they were writing Isaiah. And if you read the books, you'll see there's a lot of continuity. It's meant to be a continuous story, not necessarily three different books. So we shouldn't necessarily be super bothered by that. At the same time, there's a whole other school of thought that says, you know what, probably all of this was written by the original guy, and he was just really good at knowing what was going to happen. So if you want to ascribe to that, like, that's fine too. That is certainly not beyond the realm of God to speak into the future with a very accurate knowledge of what is to come. All that to say, this matters when we read Isaiah 40. And it matters because this book takes a radical shift between chapters 39 and chapters 40. Again, we go from Israel miraculously escaping the Assyrians to this prophecy about the Babylonians coming, to all of a sudden when we reach chapter 40, we're speaking to a community in exile. And it's important to really get a sense of what exile meant to the people of Israel. It wasn't a sense that they just took this as a punishment and they're like, oh, that's cool. I mean, we deserved it, no big deal. The people of Israel are crushed by the experience of exile. If you want some light reading, go pick up the Book of Lamentation, which is the book written immediately after the destruction of Jerusalem, and you'll find verses like this. In his winepress, the Lord has trampled virgin daughter Judah. This is why I weep, and my eyes overflow with tears. No one is near to comfort me. No one to restore my spirit. If you read the things written during the exile, there's a deep sense that not only has Israel kind of been spit out by the land, but this feeling that God has kind of like put them aside. That as his covenant people, that they feel almost that God has broken up with them. The prophet Hosea was even told that he has a son, and God says to call him Lo Ami, which means not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. This is the separation that the people felt from God. Can you imagine? Can you imagine that feeling? Maybe you felt that way in life too. Not just far from God, but crushed by God, forgotten, put aside. Do you know what that feels like? So when I read the book of Isaiah, I like to stop after chapter 39 and be quiet and remember what the people were going through in that unofficial pause between those chapters. That silence and that stillness and that pain that sits in that place that went on not for days and weeks, but for 70 years. In my mind, it's like a deep, dark fog that you couldn't cut through. Not the sort that kills you, but leaves you unable to see and to feel and to know. This is exile. The people go into exile in 586 BC, and then silence, and silence, and silence. The years go by, the decades go by. And then we hear this. Comfort, comfort, my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the wilderness prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, and every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? All people are like grass, and all their faithfulness is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever. You who bring good news to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and he rules with a mighty arm. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. Comfort, God says. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim that her hard service is over. Their sin has been paid for. God is no longer against you. This feeling of being put aside by God, of being forgotten by God, it's over. The pain is done. Into the crippling silence, a voice cries out. In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. God is coming. You have not been forgotten. And God is not just coming to comfort you, but to kind of blast a highway right back to Jerusalem and bring the people home. It says, go up to a high mountain and look down over Jerusalem and see God coming as a conquering king. Not as one who is violent or vicious, though, but one who comforts his people, who brings them like a flock of sheep. Even those who are young are carried along by the Lord as they come back to Jerusalem, as they come home. This is the passage that speaks to a nation in exile. Into all the silence, into all the death, the voice cries out, comfort. Behold, I am doing a new thing. We are going home. Amen? And of course, we're not in exile in Babylon. So it might be hard to put this passage on. I don't know if it's hard for you to get your imagination around what that feels like. But this passage has always been taken to mean so much more than speaking just to that particular situation. It speaks to exile kind of with a capital E. Exile as a place that sometimes we end up in life. That feeling we have of being separated from God, of being broken by God. The passage itself, speaking to a highway in the desert, speaks backwards. It looks backwards to Pharaoh and to Egypt and Israel being in slavery and being brought out, being made new by God and being brought into the land. And likewise, for many people who read this passage, they didn't see the exile as ending when the people came back to the land. They didn't actually understand it as the 70 years in Babylon. They actually saw it more as the 70 times 70 years that are referred to in the book of Daniel. So in other words, for a lot of people, they came back to the land, but the kingdom of Israel is never really restored. And so when Jesus is born, there was lots of people who said, we are still in exile. We are still waiting. We are still waiting for these words of Isaiah to be made true. And so each and every one of the gospel writers picks up this passage and they say, this is what it is. We're witnessing it. This is John the Baptist preparing the way of the Lord in the wilderness. Prepare the way of the Lord because Christ is coming to end the exile. That's how they understood it. And so Jesus comes and he teaches the people, and then ultimately he takes the punishment on himself. The hard service that it speaks to that has been paid double, Christ takes that all upon himself. And just as the silence of exile is broken in the original context, the curtain is torn and we come back into the loving presence of God through what Christ has done. So when we read this passage, we're not just reading about Israel and Babylon, we're reading about Jesus. We're reading about Jesus who comes to end all exile. And that said, we still wait, even though we have full fellowship with God through Christ. We live in a world that's not yet redeemed. And so there's still part of us always that until Christ returns is in exile. There's still part of us that with Moses can say, I am a stranger in a strange land until Christ comes to make things new. We might experience that as just kind of an everyday reality, but we might also go through seasons where it truly feels like we are in exile. And when you do, I invite you, pick up this passage. Feel free to sit in between 39 and 40 just for a minute. And that these words break the silence. Comfort ye, my people. I'm going to close with this story. It's kind of a big story, big overarching story that ends in a specific story. So in 2012, Susan and I got married. Yeah. And we entered into marriage with a lot of student debt. And that wouldn't have been so bad, except that 4 months into our marriage, we managed to get pregnant, which was a good time. And then Augie came along and refused to sleep through the night for the next 2 years, putting all sorts of stresses and strains on a young marriage. To pay for all of this, we took on a rental property, which didn't really actually pay us anything and ended up being a lot of huge headaches. All this, of course, was while we were trying to get a church off the ground and dealing with all the headaches of a young church. And this all reached a head in 2016, what I affectionately call the year of death. During that year, I had two close relatives die suddenly. We had our house broken into, and my health started to go bad. And so, in many ways, after that year, there was a lot of healing that came. There was a lot of ways I came out of it, but it wasn't really until I went on sabbatical last year that I began to look back and just see the degree to which it felt like exile. Not just that sense of being far from God, but being crushed by God. Can anybody relate to that? Does anybody know that feeling of feeling like, for whatever reason, you just feel crushed by God? So when I began sabbatical, I think I just wanted to get as far away as possible. And I found myself in the middle of Glacier National Park. And you can pull that up. That's what Glacier National Park looks like, by the way. If you've never been there, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. But I found myself 2,500 miles away from home in a place where nobody knew me, nobody knew who I was, nobody knew anything about me, and I just wanted to be away, get away from this pain. And if you go to Glacier National Park in June, you will find that the Going to the Sun Road, you can put up that next picture, this is the Going to the Sun Road. It's the old road that goes up through to the middle of the park. Is open to bikes but not cars. So one of the things you can do is bike right through the middle of the park without any cars being there. And I decided to take this on. And the thing about this bike ride is it's 16 miles directly uphill the entire time. You go uphill the entire time. There's no brakes in the entire thing. I decided to do this despite the fact that the day before I had taken out quite a bit of angst and pain on trying to do a 12-mile hike that was basically all uphill. So by the time I started, I was already kind of hurting. Nonetheless, I went into this and I tried to bike this road. So I got a couple miles in, took a break, got a couple miles in, took a break, walked a little bit, got a couple miles in, took a break, got about halfway up and started to realize that all the sane people were turning around. You know, this was kind of the time to get out if you were ever going to get out on this thing. But I felt like I had to keep going. And I went about another 2 miles up, and I actually fell asleep on the side of the road. You can put up that next picture. Yeah, there's the spot where I fell asleep. I was sitting on one of those rocks, and I decided I better move away because you can see if you kind of, you see that ledge there? It's a little bit scary, that moment of like, I'm going to fall asleep and tumble off this cliff, and that'll be the end of things. But I got up, and I kept going, and I just kept kind of moving up this mountain, hike a mile, and then bike a mile, and hike a mile, and bike a mile. And it was kind of my, like, Lieutenant Dan moment. You guys know this moment in Forrest Gump, the, right? Like, God, if you're going to kill me, like, let's get it over with. And I can kind of say that sarcastically, but if you've ever felt crushed by God, there's almost this sense of, like, God, either free me or kill me. Which I imagine is part of what Israel felt in exile. But I just kept pushing. And finally, I got all the way up to the top. And there's the view going down. Finally, to the top there at the Continental Divide, just completely exhausted and completely poured out. And the good thing about when you bike 16 miles all uphill, you know what happens after that? Yeah, that's right. You get to bike 16 miles downhill. And I turned around and I looked down. And you can see the next picture. That's the view down. And you go, I get to go down that thing. And it felt like, for the first time in however long, there was a turning towards home. It actually did, like I had been to the edge of exile. And here it was, I was finally going to turn back. And I know home that night was Whitefish, Montana, but there was a deeper sense of turning back towards home, Bristol, Pennsylvania, and home, the kingdom of God. And I began to bike down this road. You just fly down at like 30 miles an hour and you hope you don't fly off the edge. And I get about halfway down and you could just feel like the wind and just like the weight of God just lifting everything off of me. And all of a sudden I came around this turn and I saw this. Can you guys see it there? Looking back over what is just the most spectacular view I've ever seen, the rainbow. And there's actually a second rainbow there too. And just, you see this rainbow just completely blanketing the side of this mountain. And I just became completely overwhelmed. And part of the reality of going up this mountain is that there was no one else there. I was completely alone. I couldn't see anybody else. As far as I could tell, this was for me. And the first thing I could think of course, was Noah, the original context of this symbol, right? This promise that God gives that he'll never crush the people again. And I'm sitting there, I'm just so overwhelmed. I actually started just swearing because I couldn't, nothing else would come out of me but words I can't repeat up here. And as I'm just so overwhelmed, as I'm just feeling the weight and the pain of exile being lifted off of me, do you know what words came to me? Isaiah 40. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that as she has received double from the Lord's hand for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill be made low. The rough ground shall become level and the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. I invite you, wherever you are in exile, let those words speak to you. And when you come into exile, when you come into that hard season of life, open up to Isaiah 40 and pause just for a minute. And let these words break the silence. Comfort, comfort my people. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain shall be made low. The rough ground shall become level and the rugged places a plain, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together.
To find out more about Redemption Church, visit redemptionbristol.org.